Crouch. Bind. Set.
Joe presents The House of Rugby, Season 3.
Well, we're 10 shows into season 3 of House of Rugby, and somehow we've all managed to keep our jobs, probably through clever editing. But I have a feeling that that could all change today, because the men alongside me, virtually, sadly, because it is a lockdown, are probably going to cause more chaos than we've had before. This episode has slander all over it. It's Alex Good and Sean O'Brien. Gents, I feel that we've been building up to this one.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's one that I was looking forward to. I never was able to get my hands on Alex before, but might get my hands on him tonight virtually and see where we go from there.
Well, yeah, Sean seems to have kiboshed any ideas I had about talking about him and his life and going through his book and private life. So we'll just have to keep it clean.
We'll go through that, Alex, when we have a beer together sometime.
Alex, how is life in Japan? Is it treating you well? Have you even played a game of rugby yet?
No. we haven't played
any. How long have you been out there?
Any games, really. 3.5 months now. But we've had one pre-season game. But we've got another pre-season game this Saturday, then another one the following Thursday, and then the first game of the official season on the 20th of Feb. So
same as the Saris boys, really.
Yeah, pretty much. But you had a game this week, didn't you, mate?
I did.
I saw you played.
Good 65 under the belt now this week. Big win against Newcastle.
And I was going to call you Food Bill, because I'd never seen you play for Irish and all that.
No,
and
I'm
a
just
big contract of yours.
Only when the big games come around, I have to tug out. So that's in the contract.
Home games.
Yeah, home nice. Games only. Yeah, home games only. And happy to do that, by the way.
Yeah.
Alex, I asked this next question nervously, but what do you do to pass the time when you're not playing rugby and you've been there for 3.5 months?
Well, they obviously train us pretty hard. There's a lot of running. There's a couple of things that came up this week, which mm-hmm. I've done over the few, well, not done necessarily, but I've heard of. But they've been cut out by the producers here, apparently. Talk of bars with sex toys and kittens, yeah, is not play on. Not together, to be very clear on that one. Hasn't made the edit for that, so apologies.
Okay.
But there is one bar that I went to a while back here, which was, it's called The Valves, and it's basically a group of monks who serve you. So you've got these sort of big, fat, bald monks, and they serve you lots of beer, but they also, you sort of sing and shout loads of sermons at you. So yeah, it's a bit strange. Another one in Japan, which has blown my mind. But apart from that, it's about the only one I can tell you which isn't too out there, crazy or X-rated.
Okay.
The Japanese culture is absolutely bonkers by the sounds of it.
Well, you get my side of it. The bits I'm going to are crazy. Maybe it's pretty normal for most people probably out here. But yeah, it's just very different. It's very, very different to what I'm used to, or of yourself, which makes it very fun and interesting. Yeah.
Can I just say, I've been to Japan about, I don't know, 20 times, and I don't know if I've seen necessarily the same Japan that Alex has seen. So I don't think we need to tarnish an entire nation by Alex's stories.
No, we're not. We're just
saying. I agree.
Just saying it's culturally, it's probably quite interesting, to be fair, if you were out there for a period of time. And Alex is right. He needs to go and see the place and embrace the locals. And I'm actually thinking, Alex, I might actually turn into one of those monks. I might set up one of those monks bars over here.
Change the bridge into a monks bar.
Might be the new thing in London to try your hat at.
Talking of hats, I don't know if you saw the stories at the weekend that Lawrence Dallaglio's sort of Samuel L. Jackson wearing a flat cap backwards gained quite a lot of traction for some strange reason. And it got me thinking about well-dressed and badly-dressed players or ex-players. You guys must have seen a few on both. So let's start with the good. Who are the best dressed players that you've had as teammates or you've seen in rugby?
There's been an evolution, I think, over time. Mm-hmm. Like you look back 10 years ago, most of us, including myself, had probably flare jeans.
Ten years ago, you had flares?
Flares, yeah. 10. Well, what years is this? Yeah, probably. Actually, nah, probably 15 years ago, I should say. 10 is
5 years ago, mate.
Anywhere I actually kept some old flares to for working jeans, as I call them, on the farm. They're comfy, you know what I mean? You've a bit of room to maneuver in them. But I think I remember actually Rob Kearney, for someone who actually dresses quite well now, but very, very, he'd have his like skinny boots on with his skinny jeans, nice top, very fitted clothing. He has that body where I couldn't get away with any of that. But years ago, he used to have the flares, the long sleeved t-shirt underneath the t-shirt, and a pair of like Vans or skater boys. So I think a lot of lads were kind of like that back then when I first started out in back home, and I was very like that too. I used to wear all Wrangler stuff actually. I actually like Wrangler
shoes.
Keeping
it rural.
Yeah, because that's what was in the local shop in Tullow. Mm-hmm. Was everything was Wrangler, and I actually thought I looked pretty cool at the time. Until I look back at photos. I swear to God, all I was missing was a rifle wrapped around my back and a cowboy hat, and it would have looked like John Wayne. There's been some good ones and some bad ones, but he was one of them. Jamie Heaslip always dressed well, by the way. Always. He was always into his bit of fashion, but me, I'm very plain. So why does he turn up on
Channel 4 always in shorts, regardless of weather? That's the thing I think about rugby players. They always seem to wear shorts all the time.
Shorts and a t-shirt. If I could get away with that all year round, I genuinely would. But he travels all the time in shorts.
Shorts and Yeezys.
That's the thing.
Very odd.
Yeah. Mike Ross. Mike Ross was a very old dresser as well. Mike Ross, like, even 15 years ago, he was dressing like a lad that was 60. He'd have the shirt and the belt to be buttoned into the belly and, you know, tucked in, not pulled out a little bit. And he'd always have a lovely pair of boots on him. He wore boots before boots started to come in. So he was another one that I used to look at and go, Vito Rossi. You'd never think he was an actual athlete at any stage. But he was quite funny.
Billy Vunipola always wears his shorts with flip-flops, whether it's snowing outside, frosty. He might have a massive coat on him, but always flip-flops and shorts. And we started to notice that Nick Ezekwe, who was like his shadow just following around trying to beat Billy, he started doing the same thing. And his feet started to go blue, but he just had to carry it on because he wanted to be just like him. But one other guy, actually, who came to Saracens was Gavin Henson, obviously infamous for his fake tan and everything. And he was only with us for, I think it was about three games. And I say unfortunately, I had to room with him for a game before an away match. And so the night before, we go up to Sale. And I swear, the minute we got to the hotel, most of the boys go down for snacks or something. He just goes to the bathroom. Didn't see him for snacks. Anyways, I come back to the room. He's still in the bathroom. I'm sort of like, okay, a bit weird. Hour later, I go downstairs for dinner, whatever it was, play cards with the boys. He's still in the bathroom. I'm like, what is going on? And it's starting to stink a bit. And late the night, I just see this sort of glowing object walk past in the dark, like a luminous. And I went to go to the toilet for the first time in hours. Yeah. And it just had like little hairs everywhere. It smelled horrendous. It was like these fake tan marks everywhere. He'd spent hours just fake tanning and like shaving down and everything. But I can't tell you, the smell was horrific. And he was like a Chilean miner at the time. He was just so brown compared to what he'd gone in. It was like Sean's t-shirt to then being, you know, a wonderful orange colour. But that was quite a shock to the system, how long he spent there. But also we found out that he'd gone to local tailors and had his shorts. He'd got the kit from the kit man the day before, and he'd gone to a tailor's and had his shorts tailored and his shirt tailored. So they were tighter. So his quads and his arms would look bigger. And he'd also on the morning of a home game, he'd gone to the local gym and just done like in the middle of St Albans, not the biggest place, but with people around, morning of the game, he'd gone and done like a little gun set to try and make himself look better for the game. So, unbelievable.
That, to be honest with you,
yeah,
that is worst nightmare to have someone like that in the team. Oh my God. I'd kick him up and down the field every opportunity I could get, to be fair.
Well, It didn't really help because he played shit that game against Sale. So yeah, it doesn't always work.
So not this look good, feel good, play good. No, didn't work.
So plenty to come on the pod this week, including Jerry Guscott giving his insight into Six Nations. And we are going to take a deep look into Alex Good's soul. And it is a dark place. I don't know. We'll soon find out. And we're going to talk about Test Match Rugby because it is the Six Nations. I feel that everybody needs the Six Nations, guys. Is the first week of competition, from your point of view, Sean, the best week? Because nobody's lost a game. Everyone's going to be king of the world and the excitement's there.
Yeah, I think it is. When I look back, I think, you know, there is an excitement about going into camp and getting to see the boys again and lads from different provinces at home and different clubs. And there's a kind of, there's another intensity to it too, which is also, you know, the competitive side of it. And people are having a bit of a cut off each other. And I remember even like big European weeks and going into start Six Nations camps, it's always going to be a bit of hargy-bargy. And lads trying to choke each other and a few fisticuffs. And, oh, it's like, it's went overboard at times, but...
So just the physicality and the intensity builds up to such a point that you're almost scrapping with your teammates.
Yeah, there's always a few scraps in training. Like I'd say Alex would have seen loads of that, but we definitely on big weeks and important weeks, we just go up another level. And I suppose everyone's, you know, emotion and that side of things boils over at times, and it certainly had with me in my career. Anyway, in big weeks, I remember one week we were doing this drill with Joe Smith. It was like a 3-minute drill that he concocted after we got beat by the All Blacks in the Aviva Stadium, and it was literally 15 pads against the 15 starters, and it was like inside the 22, and you just go hard. But the pads were not allowed to hit you on top of the head or like a cheap shot. And I remember one of the boys one day coming in and smacking me on top of the head, literally in the first play of this like 3-minute drill. And I didn't even see who it was. I just grabbed him and like thrown an uppercut. But I had his jersey over his head and whacked him anyway. And all I could see was his arms like a windmill coming flying at me. But those were the type of thing. Then Joe would like lose the head with you, like, Shawnee, go on a lap and that'd be it. You'd be gone on a lap to cool down. But there's always more of a there's always more energy and more cutting people, I think, when they go into Six Nations camp and big weeks in rugby in general, especially around you like European weeks. And you know, once you get like, if you have opposition as well talking about you a lot. So the French a couple of years ago, well, not that I'm proud of this, but that 2015 World Cup game, I was so wound up all that week because they were saying they were going to bully us and going to physically dominate us. All week I was saying to the boys, they're not going to do any of this. But then again, overcooked it, didn't I? And had someone punch in the stomach after a couple of minutes on the field and missed the quarter final like in Egypt. But that would have happened this week in some of the camps. There would have been a bit of edge and a bit of contact, and lads are going to get competitive with each other, and it just drives the whole standard of training and drives the intensity within the environment. And I even seen this week that Ireland had Ulster in just training against them, and I'm sure they had like at certain points they had like contact blocks, and that would have gotten niggly, I presume, at some stage. And I'm sure like Alex probably knows from training with the boys that the English boys will be the same. When they go at it, they go at it for that period of time, and it gets everyone going. It gets everyone focused for the week ahead.
I mean, my only memory of a first Six Nations I was involved with, I think it was between James Haskell and Jeff Parling. And Jeff Parling, very studious, real line-out technician, you know, but had come through the Leicester way. And they were doing these line-outs before they came into the team bit. And Jeff caught the line out and Haskell just went, "Oh, nice catch, mate." And meant it in like a genuine way, which is unlike Haskell. And Jeff, just so in the zone with line outs, said, "What'd you say?" And just went bang, bang, left, right, whacked him. And Haskell's just there, stunned, like, boof, boof, takes them. And Jeff walks off. And Graham Rowntree comes over and goes, Haas, what the hell did you say to annoy Jeff? What is your problem? And Haas is there completely stunned, like, what? What just happened here? I cannot understand this. But the fact that he was just still standing for the rest of the week, Jeff was just called powder mitts polling because he obviously couldn't punch to save his life. But he also apologised to Haskell and so did Graham Rowntree. There's a complete misunderstanding. But yeah, sometimes you just get a random outburst and a few punches.
So in amongst all the scrapping that goes on, when do you get an inkling, Sean, that you're actually going to be in the team announcement? If, say, it's announced, it tends to be like a sort of, I don't know, Thursday lunchtime or something, if it's a Saturday match. At which point are you told as a player that you're going to be in a team?
It's usually on the Tuesday morning because they mightn't finalise the bench until Thursday, but they usually give you a heads up on the team on a Tuesday morning, and then it's announced, obviously, to the public on Thursday. But on Monday, like when you're going through walkthroughs and the detail of the game and stuff, you kind of get an inkling whether you're playing or not. And
kind of,
I say
it's pretty obvious usually. don't read anything into this. Oh, the captain and the best players are in that team, and you're in the bibs. Yeah, lads, don't read anything into it. I promise you.
It got so bad at one stage with us that Joe kept mixing and matching on a Monday, so that he'd never actually, he wouldn't give it away to you, and he had everyone on edge for those couple of, you know, that 24 hours. But yeah, I get exactly what Alex is saying. You're kind of saying, the coaches say, don't read into this now, but this is one team and this is the other, but it can all change, but it never really does. But yeah, it's usually Tuesday morning. It gets announced, and then you can actually train well together as a 15 that day. Have your day off on Wednesday. Thursday you come in, and you know it's locked away. All your game plan is locked away, and you just go and train hard for whatever period of time. And you know the rest of the week then is easy. Friday captain's run at the stadium, and you play at the weekend. So it's that's the excitement of it as well. You know, coming into camp on a Sunday evening or Monday morning, whatever it may be, and you know, hopefully praying that you're involved and involved in these big games, especially the Six Nations, you know, how exciting it is. And that's what the boys will be doing now. They'll be chomping at the bit this week.
I joke about it, but it's important that the team have time together to prepare. Mm. Like, as much as, you know, this one team with bibs, one with that, the team, you know, from the week before or something like that, that if they play well, it's going to keep the same team pretty much. So that, at that point, if you're not in the team, you're there to prepare the first team as much as possible and to help the test team go out there and do as well as they can. And you understand they want to do combinations, centres want to run together, back three want to practice the backfield, the movements, everything like that. So you're not like what the hell is going on here. You understand it. But it's very hard for the coaches to sort of keep people on edge and guessing a lot of the time, because ultimately, if the team's played well or there's an established player there who's in good form, he's going to stick with it.
And on the back of that as well, Lee, it's highly important for the lads who aren't involved to prepare that team to the best of their ability, especially going into those big games. So if you do have, like, I know not too many lads would at international level, but if you're someone who's really disappointed and they're shown at the training, etc., it's not what the bigger picture is. So you always have to think about that as well. And it's happened to me a few times in my career later on when like things weren't going so well or you were struggling with injury and you weren't picked for the starting team and you might be on the bench. It's very easy to kind of sulk and be down about it. But you have to prepare the boys as best you can when you get out there. And that actually makes the whole setup stronger. And it's hard for some people to get their head around, but
That's actually what I was going to ask. That sort of mentality where you are, you know, the team is always going to be bigger than the individual, but there must be a lot of disappointment for people. So it's, you know, the guys in the bibs aren't having to go in a bit harder. They're not trying to prove themselves. They've got to be in a situation where they are absolutely cooperating for the good of the team with everyone round about. And I think for people on the outside of team sport, it's a hard thing to get your head around.
Yeah, it is. And it's, I suppose the best example I give you was the last home game against Wales that I potentially could have played for Ireland. And and it was against France, and we were after playing Italy the week before, and I didn't have a great game, but nobody did. But I knew after the game he was going to drop me. I knew well, and I was struggling at the time with my hip, and leading into that game, I had he didn't say anything to me on Monday or Tuesday, and I was in and out of the team, so he was keeping everyone guessing, but then he announced the team, and then he announced the bench, and I wasn't on it, and I remember I was so disappointed, because it was the last opportunity I'd have to run out for Ireland in the Aviva, and because I'd signed over here at that stage, but I remember going to train. I trained probably the best I've trained on that Thursday. That I trained the whole duration of that campaign. And I had a massive row with Johnny actually at that session. As everyone does have rows with Johnny anyway. He'd fight with his toenails, but we were just getting stuck into each other a little bit afterwards. But it's a difficult place to bring yourself to, because I was genuinely shook after that, and like went home very disappointed that weekend and watched the boys play and beat France. But you have to think of the bigger picture. And then I was kind of thinking to myself, well, I've prepared the boys as best as possible. Hopefully it'll go and do the job. But at the time, you're just selfish and you just want to be playing. But you have to flick the switch very quickly. And I think you grow that over your career as well. If you're a young fella coming in, you are disappointed, but get a bit more experience and get into the dirty 30s. You know what your job is at that stage.
And Alex, there will be a lot of young players hoping to get their first cap, hoping to make their mark. In your situation, how difficult was it, or, you know, maybe it wasn't from your point of view, just keeping a lid on the emotions and the excitement that comes with knowing that you are about to play your first test match?
I guess sometimes you don't really have much time to think about it. I think the first time you go into a camp, you hope you're going to play, you're going to be involved straight away. But I had to bide my time for a Six Nations. So I was not involved, but I was training with a team, so got a sort of feel for it. And then we went on tour to South Africa, and it was this sort of second week I was on the bench. And I think I only found out on the Tuesday or the Wednesday maybe. So it wasn't that long at all to prepare yourself for it. And it just sort of comes in a whirlwind. You sort of tell a few people at home, a few friends, family, and you try and, you know, calm yourself down, because you also know, I knew I was on the bench, so you don't know how long you're going to get. You're going to get, you know, 79 minutes, you're going to get 2 minutes. You're trying to just keep the, you know, a lid on that emotion. But it's, I think international rugby, that's part of the test, is how you react to it emotionally, mentally. There's so many added pressures from the media to social media to fans to just the whole thing around it. You know, the Six Nations is huge. It's the biggest thing, biggest tournament in the world. So, you know, all that stuff you have to deal with, and you have to sort of bring it back to, you know, I'm here because I'm a good rugby player. I've got to do what I do well, do the basics well, and it'll be all right. But I've seen it distract so many people. It takes away from just preparing for the game as best possible. And you start thinking about all those other things, and you worry because your parents are worried, or your girlfriend's worried, or your family are worried about you. And you're not thinking about your job, which you do week in, week out for your club, and why you're there.
Or the 24 grand that you get for a game.
There's not a it's always money with you, that mate. Goes past where Sean doesn't bring up this England match.
I know. Like, it's either the England match fee or
because
the
salary broke
cap.
Now, aren't it?
I mean, come on, mate. Let it go.
And
let it go, pal.
Okay? The Sarries boys don't like anything to do with money.
You didn't exactly sign for peanuts at London Irish, mate. Your farewell tour. Come on, pal. What's that per minute you've been playing? You've only played about three games since you've been there.
Let's draw a line under this, because earlier on, before Alex joined us, Sean and I spoke to somebody who played for England over 60 times without the big match fees. He was playing for the love of the sport. It's Jerry Guscott. So let's talk about Six Nations. It is an exciting time of year. I think that people want live sport more than ever, and that's what's going to be coming into their living rooms from this weekend. And it feels good, doesn't it?
It feels great. I mean, it's going to be odd because of, you know, no crowds, but I think people are craving something new and different to watch on television. I mean, we've all exhausted Netflix, Amazon, Sky box sets, BT, Disney, Crumbs, I missed a couple out, I'm sure, but there's so much there, and we've wrapped through it in nearly 12 months, and now we've got rugby coming up. Do you know what? The only big change that rugby could make that would really excite me would be get rid of the substitutes, get them down to about two. I don't know what Sean thinks about that. I think it would the game would go bonkers. We'd be watching spectacular rugby.
Yeah, it's it's an interesting one for a current player to be still battling it for 80 minutes. I don't know. Yeah, I think it'd be spectacular for the last 20 minutes. I think you'd see a lot of open rugby, and I do think...
I think you'd be blown out your backside after that 20, Sean.
I've done 65 at the weekend now, and I wasn't too bad for 65. But it's one of those things. I think that the fittest would survive in that type of environment and game. And the poor old front five would have to get a bit fitter than they are nowadays. They're kind of 50-minute men now at the minute. But it is, it's something, I suppose, that's been talked about a lot of how the game can be more enjoyable. And, you know, when you bring on these wave of subs at the minute, it's kind of, or finishers as most people are calling them, it's, it changes the complex of the game and changes momentum for some teams. And, some other teams go backwards when their subs come on. So it's there's a lot of variance in the whole thing at the minute. But I wouldn't be a fan of it personally right now at my stage in my career. I'm happy to come off with 10 or 15 to go.
What is it that you miss most about your playing days in rugby? I mean, do you look at it sometimes? Do you still get excited about the idea of the start of a Six Nations or, you know, Five Nations as it was?
The excitement of Six Nations can always come back. I remember when I first stopped, I would literally, as soon as the teams, all the squads were picked for that week before the game, I would go back and think, what was I thinking? One, you want to be picked, you want to be selected. So there's a great deal of excitement. You're nervous before the start of it because you don't know, no matter how well or badly you're playing, you're not sure if you're actually going to make it because that coach never gives you the nod and the wink that it's going to happen, very rarely anyway. And you go into camp, you're going to catch up with the lads that you've just been playing against, some of it that you play with in your same club. And it's just a great environment. I mean, when I'm going back to when I first started playing in the Five Nations, we used to get together. So we never used to meet until Wednesday night before an international on the Saturday. I mean, it's just crazy. And there used to be a bit of a session on a Wednesday evening, especially with the forwards. The backs would train in some poorly lit, the old Stoop Memorial, which is now the new Stoop, Twickenham Stoop, I think it's now called. So we'd be, the floodlight was nowhere near as good as it is now. The backs would do a little bit because we get tired quickly. The forwards would be doing a massive scrummage session, line-out session, all very technical. And they'd probably have a little bit of a session after that, find somewhere nice and quiet and kind of cultural to have a couple of subs and just go over those line out calls and scrum moves again. Then we'd all gather and it probably get serious from Thursday morning because that's all we needed. That's all the practice and togetherness we needed. But yeah, it was crazy, mad. But that was the way that it was, and that's what we got used to. So I suppose I think, like all players, all retired players, you miss the camaraderie, you miss the changing room banter, you miss the training banter, you understand that you're never going to be running out in a stadium full of 60, 70, 80,000 people again and get that buzz. That buzz is incredible. I remember when, because it is coming up to the Six Nations, I remember I was chatting to someone and I just had this visualization of coming out of the changing room at Twickenham. This was before the stadium, the West Stand was transformed. So it was a wooden stadium pretty much. It's ever so noisy. You came out of these changing rooms and it was quite shuttered, and literally the door would be open to the stadium. This blinding light would come in. And then you'd move towards it and then you'd come out and there'd be this cacophony of noise. Whatever hairs you had on the back of your neck would literally stand up. And it's just an incredible, amazing, deep-reaching feeling you get. And more so at your home ground, but if I run out at Lansdowne Road, in Cardiff, in Murrayfield, Parc de Princes as it was, I had a similar feeling. I just that rush of getting ready for an international game was just mega.
I often think about, Lee, what would happen nowadays if we met on a Wednesday, let's say the forwards or the backs and went for a few pints before Saturday, or in terms of going into international camp. Like, I remember the last 2 years in international camp for me, it was like, there was a fear going into camp. And like, there was a fear of not knowing your detail and not being as fit as you could be, or not being in the best shape ever in your life. There wasn't even a thought of having a bit of crack going into camp. And I often think we're losing that character side of the game as well, because it's moved on so much professionally. And, you know, if one team is really well behaved and, you know what I mean, working hard, another, everyone's trying to catch each other. So it's I'd love if we all agreed, if Ireland, England, Scotland, and Wales all agreed, right, you have to go out one night a week. You have to go on the field, and it's mandatory to do it. What type of rugby will be played at the weekends?
In terms of Autumn Nations Cup, I know you're reasonably critical, as were most people, about the brand of rugby that was played. It wasn't the most exciting. Is there any reason to think that it's going to be different in the Six Nations?
I think the international game, that was the first time they got the international games, certainly on this side of the hemisphere, had got into international rugby in this lockdown period with no crowds. So I think it took some adjustment for everybody, and it just wasn't the greatest rugby. And it put it purely down to the guys, everybody getting adjusted to it. They've had pretty much a good, you know, good end of the season, good start of the season, wherever you are in the Northern Hemisphere. So I believe they should be adjusted. But this is tighter, tougher rugby. This is all about winning. And I can go back, I can remember as far back as playing. I'm not interested in entertaining people. You generally aren't. You just want to play and you want to win, no matter how. If you happen to score a few tries in the process, and it looks mildly or incredibly entertaining, that, I'm not kidding, that is a bonus. It's a huge bonus for everybody there and watching. The players just want to win. I think, you know, that you're seeing a few different styles come in. You've got adjustments to new coaches, Andy Farrell and Wayne Pivac just getting adjusted to what they're doing with the teams. But I think we just will see a bit of kicking, because what teams seem to be happier playing for whatever reason without it than with it. So that's why we're seeing that kicking. I don't think the Six Nations, I hope not, fingers crossed, it won't be as boring as the Autumn Nations. It can't be. I think players and teams know each other too well. They know their weaknesses, they know their strengths, and this is the Six Nations, and I just believe it will continue being as great as it's always been on the field. That's my wish. That's my hope.
As a proud Englishman, are you seeing that they're starting as favourites for this competition? You know, you agree with that through and through, or do you think France has a chance?
France have a chance. They definitely have a chance. But the trouble with France, we still see that they will give you an opportunity to win the game. That's just the nature of French rugby. England have three home games. They play Wales and Ireland away, and if they can take any of what they did to those two teams from Twickenham away to those stadiums, they'll win. I mean, I thought those games at Twickenham against those two sides was probably the highlight of the Six Nations, for me anyway, last season. The rugby was brilliant. The forwards turned up and were pretty spectacular. I'm not sure if anybody's got the capability of dealing with the carrying game that England's got up front. The amount of forwards that they have that can carry the ball compared to the other nations is still a bit more than most. I mean, Scotland always wonder why they don't do so well. Sorry to use Scotland as an example, but if you look at all their carrying forwards, they just haven't got that many. And I don't know how you think, or any side believes, they can sort of dominate for any period of time or any era without having those ball-carrying forwards, because you can't cause any damage. You can't make any dents into what is a wall of defence. The only way you've got is, you know, you either need a Finn Russell that can produce some magic that can sometimes go wrong, or you've got an incredibly accurate, well-executed kicking game.
Yeah, I think I agree with Jerry. I think it's one of the things that, you know, I've said in the past, especially Ireland v England, we just got out-muscled. And we don't have the big carriers back in the side either. Like, the closest one, I suppose, who would add a lot of value at the minute is Dan Levy when he's back fully fit. James Ryan's obviously carrying well, let's say, for Ireland. Ian Henderson when he's fit at two. But past that, like, they have to come up with a good game plan to move teams around. This collision-based game for them at the minute, I don't think will work. I think England are on top in that sense. And I think the only ones that will give them a rattle are France. And the one thing I will say about France is their defence has improved massively under Sean Edwards. And we see when they get it right how effective they can be, and they can stop England. There's no doubt about that. But if England get their tails up, you know, they're so used to playing with each other, to play a really simple game. You know, they're very, very hard to contain, and they're able to do it for long periods of time. And as Jerry said as well, the boys coming off the bench for them, they're all good carriers, they're all physical players, so they add to it again when they come on. And that's the issue at the minute. Is one thing is containing the starting 15, it's containing the finishers then as well, because they're all able to play ball.
And Jerry, let's just look ahead to the Lions, because at the moment we don't know what's happening with that. I know that you absolutely love it, as you would do having been on three tours, but I read in your column a couple of weeks ago that you were saying that, sort of against all odds, somehow the Lions must happen. Do you still think that there is a chance?
Hopefully I was meaning within that, but it must happen, whether it be in South Africa, whether it be here, or whether it be in Australia. I don't think it's feasible to happen in 22, just because of the home union's rugby schedules and how the coaches would feel in their build up to the Rugby World Cup. So, yeah, I'm not that old and traditional that I don't see a Lions happening with games being played in Wales, Scotland, England and Ireland. I just think, yeah, it'd be unusual, it'd be different, but I think that is better than nothing at all. I would hate for there not to be a Lions tour, because if it is possible, if it is feasible, if we can do it logistically, then if we could get to the moon, let's just play it on the moon. But for me, the Lions is that important that the games have to go ahead somewhere.
And you said that if you weren't playing, you would try and go as part of the team. If you weren't part of the team, you would try and go as a broadcaster. If you weren't a broadcaster, you would go as a fan. That is how much the Lions means to you.
I've just had wonderful experiences with the Lions. I've been fortunate. And, you know, two were successful in terms of win. One, we came close down in New Zealand. But all my big rugby memories are from the Lions. Because I went on three Lions tours. I think I only went on one or two England tours. That's just the nature of my career and the way it panned out. So I love a big challenge. I love people saying you can't do something, and I love proving people wrong. And for me, that's what the Lions is all about. They give you no chance. They don't expect you to win. And so when you can ram it right into them and prove them wrong, that's really good. And plus, that's when there's a lot of banter, a lot of verbals that go on throughout four seasons of rugby, international rugby, between that was the Five Nations that's become the Six Nations. And when you actually get together and you spend the best part of 6 or 7 weeks together, you understand that you might not have been such a big so-and-so as one person might have thought. You're actually a decent bloke, and you can get on, you can have a few beers and you can have a good crack. And that, for me, was what the Lions was. Against all adversity, with whatever you thought about one another, you were able to come together as one and do an unbelievable job and have an amazing time.
Yeah, I'm laughing because I'm just thinking of the crack we had on both tours as well. And that's all a part of it. You know, I've said previously on this about, you know, it wouldn't feel like to a player if it was in England or Ireland, it wouldn't feel the same. But, you know, if it goes ahead, But ideally somewhere where you can get on a flight and have a bit of crack, because that 2013, 2017 was absolutely carnage in the best way possible. And as Jerry said, you know, getting to know the boys is a big part of it, and getting to know people who you perceive to be a bit of a tosspot, and next minute they're your best friend by the end of the tour. So it's it is usually exciting, and it is a massive honour, and you know, just steeped in history and everything. So hopefully the boys get the opportunity to do that. But I hope they really have a good time as well, and they're not locked up somewhere in England or France, or England or Scotland or somewhere, that they can't let their hair down and enjoy a Lions tour for what it is.
Jerry, thank you so much for joining us. I shall see you over the next few weeks at Six Nations.
Cheers, Jerry. Look forward to it. Take care. Keep safe.
Always great to hear from Jerry. I'll be on BBC Sport with him throughout the Six Nations. Sean, one thing that you said was that on the Lions Tour, it gives you the opportunities to almost work some people out, people you thought maybe were arseholes beforehand, then become friends. Who were you talking about? Who are you talking about?
The probably biggest example for me, to be fair, going over there, was one of the fellas that got on well with the most was James Haskell. Because like I playing against him, Ireland v England, I love playing against him. He hated playing against me. And I used to think he was just a complete tosspot. Well, actually, when you we end up, I suppose, the first day over there, you end up rooming with him. And you go in and you see that he has his toenails painted and his fingernails painted and all this stuff. You kind of still think he's a tosspot. And just that, you actually start to... to get to know him and chat to him, and he tells you about his life and his family and vice versa. And then you see this side of him, which is like just a really, really good lad who has a lot going on, obviously, in his life. And his fingers in about 50 pies. But he has, in fairness, he was one of the lads who I changed my opinion on nearly instantly after a couple of days. And then you get lads like Justin Tipperick, who... you know that's a really nice guy, and you speak to him after games, and you kind of get to know him a little bit better then too, in terms of he's a quiet fella, he goes about his business, but he's a really good lad and a good lad to have a beer with and stuff. So there's always different personalities on tours, and you get to know, and I suppose the few piss-ups that you go on and the crack that you have with these boys, that's when you really get to know them. So like the first week of a Lions tour and... the first week of a tour with someone you don't, who's come into an international squad for the first time, are always a really good bonding time, and you make good memories for that night out or that day or two that you're with them, and you kind of, your perception of people changes very quickly when you actually sit down and talk to them properly, rather than someone just looking in from the outside saying, oh, that lad's a prick or this lad's a prick.
And are there people that you thought that you would get on with and then it's flipped the opposite way?
No, I think you get a feel for people after the day or two that you spend with them initially. And then you know kind of who you bounce off and who gives you energy and who doesn't. And, you know, everyone's not going to be like the best of friends, but you all get on with each other. And, you know, you're all there for the one purpose at the end of the day. So there's obviously you have favourites and then you have people who just stick to themselves and that aren't your real type of people, but you respect what they're about all the same.
Yeah, I suppose that is the lions in a crux, isn't it? When you listen to you, Sean, and Jerry talking about how much they love it, we can only hope that it manages to go ahead in some shape or form. But we did say that we were going to grill Alex in the nicest possible way, because... the point, Alex, is that I think there's so much focus on this international window and player selection. It's easy to forget those players who don't get selected when they've been playing incredibly well and all the noise, all the buzz is that they should have been selected. And you have been very much one of those people over the years. I mean, you've got, 21 England caps, but particularly in recent years, there has been so much conversation about how you played in recent years at Saracens when you were European Player of the Year in, what was that, 2019? And it seemed a constant discussion of why you should be in the England setup and you weren't. So I just wonder if you could reflect on the sort of emotions of that time.
Well, it's obviously a tough time. I think my mum always tells me I should have been picked, which is always nice. You know, I think... There's plenty of people here who go and aren't selected, who perhaps feel they should be selected, you know, in many team sports across the board. And that's part of professional sport. Everyone wants to be the number one, the Johnny Wilkerson, the Owen Farrell, you know, and play every week and be that great. And everyone sort of strives for that. But there's also a lot of players who don't reach that level. And I think ultimately you have to get your head around it is you have to believe you're doing everything possible to get picked, and that you're playing, you know, you're playing well enough, and that you believe you should get picked, but it comes down to one man's opinion ultimately. And you can't listen to the media too much, or you know, your friends and family. In a sense, you've got to trust the people who you know, and who are the best coaches you've been around, who are telling you, you know, you're doing this well, you're doing that well, you should work on this, keep doing this, and then keep working your game. But it's a tough period for any player when you believe you're good enough and you're playing well enough and you don't quite get that opportunity, and you have to sort of harness that either anger, frustration, whatever it is, and put it into your rugby. And I was always, you know, pretty happy with how I always go back to Saracens and try and just put a best foot forward and play well, whether it's international period or whenever. And I was given a lot of help from the coaches at Saracens to a guy called David Jones, who sort of helps with all our personal development program stuff. And he's really good at just sort of breaking down the psychology of it. And you just sort of sometimes offload, chat to him about it. And then you come out and you know you've got the support of your club and the coaches, the players, and you just play as well as you can do and try and forget about it, which is hard because every man and his dog has an opinion. You know, your family are telling you, oh, of course you should be picked. And that sometimes makes it trickier. But ultimately, you just have to keep playing well and keep knocking on the door and hope that you get that chance.
What kind of, if you don't mind me asking, Alex, what kind of conversations, though, like what kind of things were the coaches telling you that you needed to do to get on the team? Because like from an outsider, like you're saying, we look at you and we go, he's in the team, they're way more dangerous. But like what are you saying to them then? Like that's they're the conversation I actually am interested in.
Yeah, it depends on the coach a bit. I think with Stuart Lancaster, you could really, you know, ask him, you know, really exactly what he wanted, what he needs to work on, and he would tell you, you could do this or that, or you know, Mike's playing really well, Ben Foden's playing really well, and just keep going out there working hard. I'm happy with you in training. Keep, you know, helping the team, being competitive, etc. Sometimes with Eddie, it's a bit trickier. You want to ask, and you know, I think the example I always give is, and we'll probably get down this route at some stage, is when did you probably know you weren't going to play? Or I think we went to Australia in 2016. I'd just been player of the season in the Premiership. I think I got man of the match in the final, and then a week later we were in Australia, and I remember the first week I trained, you know, pretty well, not amazing, but well enough, and came to decide in the first game. And I think Eddie said, I think you've dropped too many balls in training, or you haven't trained well enough. And I sort of went through all the training, and I think I dropped one ball or something like that. And I was like, and I remember thinking, yeah, do I make an enemy out of it? Or do I sort of go out, this is rubbish, and go at him? And I sort of spoke to some of the other coaches I knew well, and they said, look, just keep training hard, keep working hard. And it came to the second week and the boys had won. And it's just a feeling I have. And then the third week, I'm just going to stick the same team. And didn't give me loads to work with. And I would ask, you know, what do I, he's, oh, it's just a feeling or just a sense. And that's probably his honest assumption tonight, just a feeling he had. But it's hard as a player to know what you need to work on, what you need to keep improving. And the general thing with Eddie was keep working your speed, keep working on high balls, etc. Keep working on your game, keep, you know, trying to be explosive. And that was his general theme. It wasn't like a constant daily, weekly, monthly work on it. It was just, this is, you know, this is what I want, and keep going towards that. But I think I knew that I was playing as well as I had played. We're on the tour. I wouldn't necessarily say the other players were playing amazingly at the time, and I didn't get a chance. And I came home, and a really good friend of mine who's a coach just said, oh, he's not going to pick you, so, you know, get your head around it. And it was pretty brutal. I was like, oh, I don't know about that. But he was right. I think at that point, I knew deep down I wasn't the type of player he wanted or a certain way. And it perhaps made it a bit easier at that point, because I just went, right, just going to focus on Sarries, everything about playing for the club that I love. I'm just going to keep working really hard about working hard at my game, and the more I can win there, the better, really. And that was my focus, and it made it a bit easier just to narrow it down to look, I can put everything into the club, and it means even more to me.
So, if it was seen as a sort of squared off as an Eddie problem, you know, if Mark McCall was in charge of England, for example, would you be an England regular? Do you think you were good enough to be an England regular at that time, particularly, say, those 2016 to 19?
Well, you know, to say it's a Eddie Jones problem is not necessarily true. Like, he had a certain vision for the way he wanted the forward to play, and you know, whether that was because of the combination of the back line or whether it's just the way he felt I played, you know, that's something you have to ask him. Look, I like to believe, yeah, if Mark McCall had been head coach, I probably would have had a better chance. He knows my game really well. He's picked me at fullback for, you know, 10 years or so. And, you know, even when Liam Williams came, you know, he played on the wing, I played at fullback, and it worked really well. So, look, but yeah, this isn't me going on about how good I think I was or, you know, how great. It's just, I think as a player, you believe that a lot of players believe they should be in a team, and I believe that I was good enough and I was playing well enough and I deserved, I think I deserved a chance, and I didn't get that, which was sad and a shame. But, you know, I don't sit at home now and lose sleep over it. It is what it is, and, you know, I'm very happy with my career so far, and I can keep building on that. And I think once you come to terms with how you're going to deal with it and sort of not letting all the negative factors come in and get wound up by all the press say this and so says that. Ultimately, what matters is what your club coach thinks, the other coaches at the club, and what Eddie Jones thinks. And you can't please everyone in this world, and you have to just go and go, right, I'm going to do everything I can, work at my game, keep playing well, and what will be.
Good attitude.
And that coaching thing, though, Sean, is you know, we see it time and time again. If you get a situation like you had where a Joe Schmidt leaves Leinster for the national job, or, you know, Gregor Townsend left Glasgow and got the Scotland job, there will be a few people, you know, whether it be at Leinster or Glasgow, that would be thinking, OK, he knows my game. He knows how I play. He knows my pros and cons. And it's maybe a bit eases into a bit more comfortable path.
Yeah, no, that's definitely 100% the case, because the game plan, let's say, that when Joe was in charge of Leinster, was based around, let's say, the key men in the side. And when he went to Ireland, that was the case. It was just brought straight to Ireland. So it was obviously an easier transition for a lot of us, because we knew what he wanted as a coach, first and foremost, and he knew what we could bring as players. So he was sticking to what had worked for him at the club system into the international system initially. And it was like, it makes it an awful lot easier. And plus, you can have those really, really honest conversations and say to him, where am I now? What do you really think of me? Where do I need to improve? And how can I get better? And how can I stay in the team? And like, when you build a relationship, I suppose, with someone, it's like Alex going to talk to Mark McCall in the morning. It'd be like having a chat with your best friend, probably, because he knows Alex so well. He knows exactly the way he is, and he'll tell him exactly what he, you know, what he wants. He just won't play lip service. So, like, I've had coaches in the past, and I've heard them say the same thing. Oh, you've dropped a few too many balls, or you haven't done this and you haven't done that. And you go back to the footage because you're half paranoid, and you've done none of what they've said. They're just trying to justify it for themselves and give some sort of a reason. But it's definitely made easier when you have a coach who goes from one to the other, 100%.
And are you at peace with everything, Alex, do you think? You're sort of, it's all comfortable with you now?
Look, I don't make any bones about it. It's a hard period when you're not selected and it's your job. You know, like, we'd all love to play every week, as I said, for your country. And it isn't easy. And it's probably sometimes harder, I'll say this, when you turn up to training and you're in the camp for a number of years, and you go, you know, Monday, you come on Sunday night after a game, you're tired, you train hard Monday, train hard Tuesday, and then, or, you know, holding the pads, so to speak, and then off you go on Tuesday afternoon back to your club, and it's just that revolving door. You just go back and forth. And that, I know a lot of players who really struggle with that. And it's not easy, and you don't feel like you get a chance. It's not really long enough in training to ever impress. But as I said, I think earlier, is once a team's set and they're doing well, you know it's not going to change. And all you can really do is harm yourself, because if you go in there with a bad attitude, you don't train well, then you'll be out. But if you go in there and you just try and be competitive, you show that it means something to you and you're just going to keep knocking on the door, then that kind of shows your attitude and your resilience. And look, I think to answer your question, I might piece with it. Well, yeah, there's times when I would, wish I'd played a bit more there. I wish I'd got that chance. You often think about it, but I don't, what I mean is I don't lose sleep over it now because it's been done and yeah. I don't have a regret about it. I don't wish I'd done something differently. You know, I know that I was playing well and, I felt I deserved a chance and that's really, I guess, what matters. And it, you know, but at the same time, I had a great time at the time with Saracens. We won a lot. I was very happy. I was happy with my form. And we move on. And, you know, in a very cheesy way, I won't let not being selected define me as a rugby player. And that is, you know, cheesy. But at the same time, it can't. Otherwise, it just consumes you and just eats you up, really. And I just try not to allow it to happen.
Alex, thank you for being so honest. Interesting to hear your stories, and I'm sure people at home will appreciate your honesty as well. So let's move on now though to Six Nations, because there are three matches this weekend. It's the opening round and it's Italy, France that kick things off. So guys, just your predictions really. Are we expecting France to dominate this one?
France for me all the way.
Yeah, I agree. Nothing much to add there. I think France are looking strong and building nicely.
Okay, so later on the Saturday, 4:45 kickoff, it's England-Scotland. The last time at Twickenham, it was the 38-38 all thriller. But what are we expecting this time, Alex?
Yeah, I think England will dominate this game. Partly because I think they've just come back off the autumn internationals. There's good strength in depth, but they're coherent. They're in a good place. And I think they'll make a big emphasis on starting well, starting strong, and they'll come out of the blocks and go for a Scotland up front and just try and apply a lot of pressure with the kicking game.
Agree. Too big, too strong. Scotland missing two of their key players in the hooker position is not good for their pack either. And I can see England doing a big job on them.
Well, I'm at Twickenham on Saturday, so I'll be hoping for the sort of repeat second half from 2 years ago. But that's what Scottish people always hope for. And then on Sunday, we have, which is going to be a really interesting matchup. I know that Ireland bossed Wales at the Aviva in November in the Autumn Nations Cup. But Sean, how do you see this one playing out?
I think it'll be a tight game. I think Wales will be better than they were in the autumn. Mm-hmm. I do think Ireland will be a little bit better too. And better organised, and hopefully we get to see a little bit more of the new style that they're trying to implement. But I think it'll be a close game, but Ireland to win.
For me, I'm going to go Wales. I think at home, unlucky Sean. I think at home Wales, they'll have the expansive play, but they'll also have a physicality in defence. I think this Irish team, obviously still very strong, but I think they're finding their feet still. So I think the home advantage for Wales will just make them pip Ireland.
Okay, so much rugby to look forward to this weekend. Gents, thank you very much. I think we've all scraped through this one with our jobs intact. So I suggest that we quit whilst the going is good and we reconvene next week. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the House of Rugby Season 3 on Joe.